We begin in the name of the source of life, who is infinite compassion, who is seeing, who is hearing, who communicates, who has given us all the tender feelings in our own hearts. We begin in the name of that one. Bismillah Rahman Rahim. And our subject today, a subject which I see as an exploration, is the subject of humanness. And it's not an accidental subject. It's really at the heart of this path that we call Sufism. I remember when I first encountered this path, my first and most beloved sheikh said, "You know, you need some work to be human. In one sense, it's given to us, but there's also a work of being human." And that's one of the ways in which I understand this process we call Sufism. I could also call it an education of the heart, an education of the whole human being, an education that has no limited classroom and no hours, but 24 hours. So those of us who are interested in Sufism, you and me, this is our business. It's the education. It's nothing less than the education of the whole human being. And so that makes it a vast subject. It touches on every aspect of life. It's nothing so small as meditation, and meditation is immense. You know, it's more than any spiritual practice. It's how we live our lives. It is how we incorporate into our consciousness all the levels of being on which a human being can be conscious. In other words, it expands our whole notion of life from a limited dimension to a multidimensional reality. Because what you are can be summarized by the terms inner and outer. We're here to balance the inner and the outer. But the inner is a vast realm with its own levels. So, for instance, as vast as this outer world is, and the things that concern us in this outer world, most of our real concerns are of the invisible. Most of what we really treasure is invisible. Our relationships, our happiness, our love, our conscience. And of course, my guiding light, spiritual mentor, has been Jalaluddin Rumi, who has become so popular and well known in the West in recent decades. If we look really at almost any page that Rumi ever wrote, we find we find him calling us to something beyond appearances, to something beyond this phenomenal world. We find him urgently wanting to share with us something about the abundance, the beauty, the mercy of something that, it's invisible, it is mysterious, it is profoundly intelligent, it is profoundly generous. And he wanted passionately to communicate the reality of that something to us. And that's on every page and in every line that he ever wrote. Whether he wrote the most exalted poems or the most pious prayers, and in some cases even some rather vulgar stories, the point was always one, to remind us of that one reality or one truth. So our fulfillment and destiny as human beings is absolutely tied to our realization of a relationship with that infinite beauty and generosity. Today, we're faced with unique challenges as human beings. And that makes us subject of humanness. And what is a human being? What is the possibility of being human? Makes this a most urgent subject. But before we go too much further into this, and I promise you not to give you a 2-hour lecture, because I know this is a sleepy time of day, we're going to have some sound, we're going to have some very gentle movement, just a walking zikr, and we're going to also have some sohbet, what we call spiritual dialogue. But I'd like us to begin by making use of one of God's beautiful gifts, which is sound, and particularly one of the divine names, which is the name of Hu. And Hu, you know, it's actually the Arabic pronoun. We say Allahu. I call it the pronoun of divine presence. Interestingly, it's like the relative pronoun in English. If I say, who are you? Who am I? And interestingly, too, we use this word human. There is an interpenetration of the divine being and human being. Now, we can unify our hearts, minds, voices, intention together and bring some even greater harmony into this gathering of lovers, lovers of God, just by joining our voices with the sound of Hu. And the number of Hu in esoteric numerology happens to be 11, so we use that number often when we recite Hu. We say it 11 times. And 11 is the number of dimensions in the universe. According to physicists on the cutting edge, who say if the laws of physics are to be resolved, they will be resolved with 11 dimensions. And I said to one, how do you know, not 10 or 12? He said, no, it's going to be 11. And somehow they know that. Well, incidentally, Hu, which is the pronoun of divine presence, it is the sound of being beyond manifestation. It is the identity of this whole existence and non-existence. Who? So join me just 11 times. Bismillah. And also feel as if the Who is coming through you. In other words, it's coming from a non-dimensional place, placelessness. And we're bringing it into this world through our hearts and our voices. Bismillah. Who? Yeah. into the silence, conscious and grateful for each breath. Think on this journey that we're all taking. One of the inevitable outcomes is that our sense and understanding of the divine, our concept of the divine, will inevitably undergo changes, sometimes in the form of shattering of idols, for one thing. Shattering of limited concepts, shattering eventually of a duality. But it's a beautiful journey that reveals to us more and more what we are, and more importantly, what this divine being is. Llewellyn said it very pointedly once in a talk that he gave, and I never forgot how he put it. He said something like this, you know, you begin the journey and you think that you are taking the journey. You think the journey is all about you. And you have all these concerns about your journey, your spiritual life, your practice, your beliefs. And you go on this journey for a while, but you reach a threshold. And I don't know if we're all ready for this, but I think many of us have understood this threshold, where we realize that the journey, the important thing about this journey is not me, not you, but him, who we begin to see that it's all about the divine reality that has been calling us, guiding us. Like the story this morning of the young lady and her beloved, you know, to be so in love. That's a different kind of love than the kind of love that desires and wants to grab and take and possess. That kind of love that wants to grab and possess is a very limited form of love. You can call it desire love. But there's another kind of love that we grow into when we realize that we are just falling into the magnetic field of something very lovable, very beautiful, something very powerful. And I trust that you all have a glimpse, a sense of what I'm talking about. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here at this moment. Now, I'm sorry that my dear brother Imam Bilal is not with us this weekend, because he certainly would have a lot to share in the way of knowledge from the classical heart of Sufism, from the Quran and the Hadith and the great Sufis. And so, with his absence, I feel some responsibility to also represent some aspects of this origin of Sufism and its fundamental source. So, to go right to that source, I'm just curious. How many people in this room would know or have heard, have read the very first words revealed to the Prophet Muhammad by the angel Gabriel? A few. So good. Well, it's my pleasure to share that with you. You know, this is a good place to begin because it addresses this subject of humanness and our relationship with something, with some mystery. So the Prophet Muhammad was about 40 years old. In other words, he had reached the age of maturity. He also used to spend a month or so every year in silent retreat and fasting on a mountain in a cave. And this was unusual because he lived in a culture that really had no spirituality or had very little spirituality. It was about as godless a society as has ever existed. They had some superstitions and they had a nice assortment of idols at the Kaaba. But they didn't have a profound tradition of spirituality, as most parts of the world did have by that time. So for him to be practicing in this way was rather unusual. And he was among a handful of people who were called, this wasn't a sect, but they called such people Hanifa, meaning they were people who somehow had some sense of some primordial religion related to the prophet Abraham, some simple trust in the divine, without rituals, without a scripture, just a kind of pure, let's call it monotheism. And there was a handful of people in his society who were interested in this, and he was one, and he would spend at least a month every year in this cave. And it was during one of these retreats that a being appeared to him, and it said, "Read or recite." And he said, "I don't know how." It said again, "Read." He said, "But I can't read." He was unlettered. And then this being grabbed him in a strong embrace and squeezed him and said, "Ikra bismi rabbika alladhi halak, halakal insan min alak. Ikra warabuka warabuka akram aladhi alama bil kalam alama insana ma'lam ya'lam." You can maybe hear some of the poetry of it. I could sing it, but its meaning is this: read in the name of your Lord, your educator, your sustainer, who created the human being from alak. And this word alak is a very important word, terribly mistranslated routinely in most versions of the Quran as clot, the human being who is created from a clot. That's not what it says at all. This word alak is a beautiful word. It is a word that suggests relationship. It suggests a linkage. It suggests a mutual connectedness. In fact, it's a very good word to describe the structure of DNA. It is a symbol of the whole geometry of life. So read in the name of your Lord who created the human being from this mutually linked substance. Read, for truly your Rabb, and Rabb is a word translated as Lord, but it really means the one who nurtures and educates. read, for truly your educator is generous, is most generous, is the most generous, who taught with the pen, the kalem, taught the human being with the pen. And the pen here, now the prophet couldn't even write, but the pen is a symbol. You know, of something in the hand of the unseen. Writing, calligraphy is a beautiful thing. That point where the point of the pen and the ink meets the paper is a profound moment. It says elsewhere in the Quran that if all of the seas were ink, that the names of your Lord, you could never write all the names of your Lord. So who taught with the pen is the archetypal intelligence, taught the human being what it did not know. So this was the first revelation. The prophet, by the way, didn't immediately get that he was to be a prophet. In fact, he was worried that he was going insane, and he ran home to his wife, and he sort of threw himself on her breast and said, "Cover me." And he said, "I'm afraid I'm possessed or I'm going mad." And his wife, who was a wise woman, significantly older than him, said, "Muhammad, a man like you, who is so responsible, so sincere, who cares for neighbors and relatives and everybody, a man like you doesn't go crazy." Eventually, these revelations continued over time. In response to the needs of a community that was beginning to receive something in the way of a vertical transmission, a grace from the divine. And a grace from the divine that also said, this has happened many times before, that this message, this truth has come to all human communities in their own language, and this is just one more installment and seal upon all of those revelations authenticating their truthfulness. The same message that has always been brought to human beings. But for our purposes here, the really significant thing is this relationship, that there is something that spoke out of the depths of nature, out of the intelligence of life, and spoke to this extraordinary soul and began a process of education. Some of us at some times may have conceived of the divine as being something perhaps abstract and impersonal, especially if we've rebelled against the kind of upbringing, religious upbringing and conditioning we might have had, where, you know, the idea of a too anthropomorphized God was beaten into us. And then we rebel against that. We rebel against that fairy tale divinity, and begin to see the divine instead as some, perhaps, light, pure light. That sounds good. Light. Let God be light, and then I can get some if I want some. I can get more light from the being, the absolute being. Or consciousness is another way we conceive of the divine. And sometimes we may also conceive of it in the very sublime form of God is love, a beautiful Christian teaching, not only Christian. But here is something perhaps even a little different, namely a relationship that is an active relationship. something like a dialogue, perhaps even a challenge. Because our limited self, our false self, may need to be challenged. Our illusions may need to be challenged. There may need to be a breakthrough to begin to grasp the mercy of this divine being. The quality that we find in the Quran, the emphasis that we find, which has permeated all of Sufism and given Sufism its center in a way, is the centrality of the divine intelligence, the divine mercy, and all the qualities of the divine being. This, its centrality as the master truth of our existence, and learning to remember that, to trust that, to rely on that in a radical way. And through that reliance and the transformation of the character that happens through trusting in that infinite power, to eventually produce the fruit of the mature human being. Not someone who escapes this life and its suffering. Not someone who graduates from the course and, you know, disappears in a flash of light. But someone who makes the journey to union in communion, who reaches and knows and experiences the bliss of intimacy with God, but takes that bliss, that beauty, that love, that consciousness, and begins to integrate it into human character itself, into creating the kind of human being you might like to sit down and have a cup of tea with. In other words, something quite ordinary in a way, and quite extraordinary in other ways. The word insan in Arabic has a couple of interesting roots, root meanings. And one of the root meanings is heedless, the heedless one, the forgetful one. But another significant root meaning of the word insan is the one who has a capacity for intimacy. And the most important absolute intimacy that we are destined for is that intimacy with the divine. And that's why in our tradition the saints are called awliya. That's the plural of wali. And wali means a friend and protector. So the saints, those who have realized this intimacy, are friends. They're our friends, and they're God's friends above all. But in being God's friends, they are the friends of God's creation. So what a beautiful concept. These are the kind of concepts that have given Sufism its character and fragrance. Awliya. And we call upon those awliya not as something, not as personalities, but as beings who realized or who became so transparent to the divine reality, who understood that their content, that their the essence of their being was like a light inside, reflected from the divine being. And the more we can make our personality, or even our ego, our selfhood, transparent to that light, then your personality, your selfhood, becomes like a lamp, the lamp of that light, able to bring that light into the world. But if the lamp is covered with layers and layers of dark material, or if the lamp is put under a bushel, as Jesus said, it can't be seen. In our tradition, absolute being, or God, or Allah, has several key attributes. And when you hear these attributes, well, let me tell you what they're said to be. God is knowing. God is aware. God is hearing. God speaks. God wills and acts. And God loves. Now, the thought might occur to you that this almost sounds a bit anthropomorphic. I mean, are we projecting our qualities on some fanciful idea of the divine? In other words, are we creating an anthropomorphic God? Are we creating a God in the form of the human? I don't know if you've ever felt this way, but sometimes I've looked at the accomplishments of human beings, the accomplishments of the great saints, and the ideas that they've come up with, the ideas Rumi offers us, or the teachings of Jesus, or the teachings of Muhammad, or other great prophets. And I almost want to say, if there is no God, then the human being is almost God, to even think these thoughts. I know that may sound a little blasphemous to some. Please don't misunderstand me. But the extraordinary thing is, we can project our immature qualities on the divine and create a God that is arbitrary in his wrath, a God that is unreasonably jealous, or we can, for that matter, create a God that is sickeningly sweet and sentimental. This would be an anthropomorphic projection. But consider the fact that if God is conscious, God speaks, God listens, God sees, God knows, God wills, all of these qualities, reverse the whole thing and consider for a moment that it may be we who are the theomorphic beings. We are the beings who are created in the form of God. A teaching which is at the heart of the whole prophetic Abrahamic tradition. And reflect for a moment on the idea that the tenderness that we sometimes feel in our hearts is in fact an attribute of reality. That those flashes of compassion flashes of forgiveness, flashes of unity, are aspects of the reality that we live in, and not just merely the epiphenomena of our own neurochemistry. That what we experience in our own interior being is in fact a microcosm, a sampling of all of the attributes of the divine reality. And that the human being has been given a heart as our most important organ of perception, far more important than the mind. This can be described in a lot of ways, scientifically, spiritually, and psychologically. There are so many beautiful sayings in the tradition about the heart. One of them is this. God says, "My heavens and my earth cannot contain me. Only the heart of my faithful servant is expansive enough to contain me." God says this. And the people who, of faith, are described as those whose hearts tremble in humility before the unseen. So, this process of becoming human, of educating the whole human being, is a process that centrally involves the heart and its awakening and purification. And a definition of Sufism, and there could be many useful definitions of Sufism, but one that has been used for a long time by the masters of the path, they call ilma tasawuf, the science of purification of the heart. It is a science of awakening and purifying the heart so that the heart can see. And what does the heart see that the mind doesn't see and that the senses don't perceive? Reflect for a moment. Let's say, imagine your life if all you knew were the reality of the senses. You know, you could taste things, you could see things, you could feel the breeze on your face. And let's say, let's add to that, that you also have a brain. So the brain can analyze what's going on. It can speak. And let's even throw in a little bit of desire, because you need a little desire to get the food in your mouth, you know, and get up in the morning. So you've got those basic elements. Let's say that's is what you've got as a human being. What kind of life would that be? Would it be more than any more than a machine? It wouldn't even be at the level of an animal yet. Because animals at least feel some love. But imagine what the human being's life would be like without the dimension of the heart. And by the heart, I don't mean, I'm not talking about some vague sentimental metaphor for nice feelings. Let's be precise, because the term kalb in our tradition is a very precise term. It's precise in the Quran and can be analyzed, and there are seven stages of the heart and seven diseases of the heart and seven remedies of the heart that can be uncovered in the Quran. And it's a very objective faculty of the human being. And put simply, it's the faculty that ties together the individual human ego or self on the one hand, and pure spirit on the other. And helps to create the relationship between pure spirit through the mediation of the heart, and then gives it to the self, to the selfhood. So the heart at the center of our being is an organ for knowing qualitatively, for a qualitative knowing beyond the knowing of the senses, beyond thinking. And what do we mean by a qualitative knowing? We mean, for instance, when you walk out at night and you glimpse a clear sky and you see the infinity of stars in front of you, and for a moment you feel tender and humbled and grateful, that's a sign that your heart is functioning. When the heart is not functioning, we look at this world and everything is a mere thing. Everything is an object. Even people look and seem like objects. And when we see people as objects, how do we treat them? What relationship do we have to them? That othering, that objectifying of others, of seeing them as things. You know, this is sometimes the way the military thinks, or the way bureaucracies think, or the way institutions think, and the way we think when our hearts are not awakened. This morning, Pirzia talked about bringing the sacred back into life, the necessity of seeing and acknowledging the sacredness of life. Well, this too is a function of the heart. The being who has an awakened heart, like our Native American people, to them this whole world was animate. Everything they saw was full of life. That too can be the sign of an awakened heart. You know, in our Mevlevi tradition, the tradition that comes down from Rumi, we have embodied in our practice what's called an adab. Adab means a spiritual courtesy, the manners of the path, but it's more than just a formal etiquette. It's a consciousness raising courtesy. And we say, for instance, I take a glass of water, and as I take it, I feel, in some sense, I know that this glass holding this water is in service to me. And for that, I'm thankful and respectful. And we have a term, and it translates as seeing with. And a dervish, before he takes a sip, or before he puts on, or she puts on, a cloak, a scarf, and put it on. And that act is called seeing with, which means you see it, and it sees you. You're seeing each other. And that's part of the courtesy of the tradition, that you begin to approach even inanimate objects with that kind of conscious relationship. And when the heart is so awakened, I know of people who have gone through intense spiritual processes and have come out on the other end of it and were in such a tender state that they had to learn how to walk on the ground, because they felt such even sensitivity to the earth and the grass. They had to get used to stepping on grass again. Their hearts were so open. And at the same time, there's a danger in opening the heart if you're not ready for it. Because in opening it, you are vulnerable. So what has to be taught at the same time is the invulnerability of your own essence. To know that at the core of your being, at the core of your humanness, you are essentially invulnerable, like a diamond. That the essence of your spirit, the God-given divine essence at the center of your being, has an invulnerability that cannot be damaged. To learn this, many experiences are necessary, obviously. It's not a cheap thing. It's not something that we get just by hearing about it. Rumi says, describes a treasure in the ruins. He says, demolish the house so that the treasure that lies underneath the house might be found. The house could be your whole conventional life, your ambitions, could be your marriage, could be anything that gets in the way of knowing that treasure that's at the root of your being. And Rumi also says, he alone has the right to destroy who knows how to rebuild better than before. And this tells us that there are many powers in this universe. Some of them are destructive and powerful. Some of them are beautiful, tender, and merciful. But we're taught that the attributes of mercy predominate over the attributes of wrath. That the attributes of wrath, in fact, are in service to the mercy and help sometimes to return us to understand that mercy. Every surah of the Quran begins Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We begin in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. But these terms need some explanation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Rahman is the grace that is showering down on all of creation all the time. It's unstoppable. It's infinite, it's perpetual, it's overwhelming. And it goes to the good, the bad, and the ugly. It goes to the heedless and the heedful, the mindless and the mindful, the thankful, and those of sheer ingratitude. All receive this Rahman. That's the nature of God, to be that way. But the Rahim is something different. By the way, both of these words come from the root word meaning womb. So the two fundamental attributes have the nurturing power of a mother's womb. The Rahim, translated as mercy, is that power that we discover in life, in existence, in our sufferings, that if we turn to that infinite source, if we turn to Allah, if we turn to God, we will find the mercy, the grace, the strength, the qualities we need to get through whatever pain, difficulty, or loss we're facing. And that all of those experiences of life that we could class in the category of suffering and loss and grief, that those experiences can bring to us a profound strength to our soul if we turn, if we orient ourselves in the direction of our source, of our beloved, of that power that had Rumi in awe. That had Rumi ecstatic and insanely in love. this being a human being. When the human being begins to open up to this relationship and all of its qualities and all of its beauty and all of its creativity, is astounding. And sometimes, you know, next week I'll actually be speaking to an audience that will be 100% Muslim and mostly African American. And I'll be trying to get through, or what I hope to share is the beauty, the mercy, the tenderness of this relationship. And sometimes people turn religion into something like a legal contract with the divine. This happens in all religions. It's happened in Judaism, Christianity, and it certainly happened in Islam. There are those who, legalistic thinkers, who present the whole relationship with the divine as if it was some kind of contract, which we had to go over the, you know, every clause of and dot every I, in order to be worthy. But it's clear in so many ways at the root of our tradition, and that is going right back to the Quran, that one of the most important messages in the Quran is opening the heart to God, living in a state of wonder, seeing the signs of God. When it said in Surah Baqarah, wheresoever you turn is the face of God. That's evidence of an open heart. And for me, the term zikr, or remembrance of God, could almost be translated by the term wonder. To live in that state of mindful wonder, as if every moment is a revelation.